Moss v. Bear Stearns, Mr. Schaefer.
Good morning. I'm Peter Schaefer, and I represent the estate of Vincent P. Koth, the plaintiff and appellant in this case. In this complaint, the estate alleged that Patrick O'Meara, a broker at Bear Stearns, committed specific deceptive acts in violation of Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 and Rules 10B-5A and 10B-5C thereunder. The deceptive acts were committed in order to open an account at Bear Stearns for International Investments of Elgin to serve as an account in which the estate's securities were sold, the proceeds traded in other securities, and ultimately misappropriated for the benefit of O'Meara and Arthur McDonald, his co-scheme.
But who is deceived? I don't understand that.
The deception is, in this instance, would be in order to open the account.
No, but who was deceived?
It would be Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns was deceived.
And also the plaintiff.
Excuse me?
The defendant.
Bear Stearns is the defendant.
No, Bear Stearns is a defendant, not as a direct for direct liability, but under a controlled person theory of liability.
But Bear Stearns doesn't claim to be the victim of any deceit. And I don't understand how you can sue on the basis that Bear Stearns was deceived.
Because, Your Honor, the deception is part of a scheme to defraud the estate. The deception was necessary.
I can understand that.
Excuse me?
I can understand a claim that the estate was deceived, but it's the estate's administrator that was doing this stunt.
Yes. And
how was the estate deceived?
In order to implement the scheme, it was necessary to open an account at Bear Stearns in order to sell the securities. The deception was necessary in order to have that account opened and the securities sold on behalf of the estate. So the estate securities sold. The deception was part of the scheme. The scheme defrauded the estate. And consequently, it was deception. Any deception, as the statute suggests, any deception in violation of a rule of the SEC under 10b-5.
Even if it's not the victim who's deceived?
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the O'Hagan case, the fraud...
The victim was the tender offer bidder, and it was deceived.
The deception...
What's your best case for the proposition that if the person who is deceived is not only not the victim, but a defendant, you have a good claim?
It would be that the securities laws do not
What's your best case?
O'Hagan cites that case, and O'Hagan states that.
Okay.
O'Hagan states that an action does require deception, which is in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. That's the element of the fraud, but does not require deception of an identifiable purchaser or seller. And as a result, if the deception is part of a scheme and the scheme defrauds the estate, then the estate has a cause of action under Rule 10b-5, because the statute is very definite that it does not limit the type and nature of the deception. Rule 10b-5a, Rule 10b-5b both speak in terms of any scheme, 10b-5a, any act, practice, or course
okay.
of business.
Can I try once more? Do you have any case in which the supposed deceived person was a defendant?
Your Honor, I don't have a case because Bear Stearns is not the defendant as a direct liable. It's not directly liable it's liable under a controlled person theory, which has entirely different elements to it. In many cases under the securities laws, the broker deceives the brokerage firm in connection with the broker's scheme against a customer. That doesn't mean that the broker-dealer is not liable as a control person, assuming the elements are met there. The deception here is committed by the directly culpable person. That's O'Meara. That establishes the violation of 10b-5, for which Bear Stearns would be liable as a control person, irrespective of the fact, as happens routinely in securities fraud cases, that the brokerage firm is defrauded by...
Another way to ask this, how does this scheme hurt the securities markets? It certainly hurts the estate, but how does it hurt the operation of securities markets? It just means that instead of McConnell trading on the estate's account, he trades on his own account.
Well, the action hurts. The harm here is in connection with the purchase or sale of a security.
The harm is to the estate, but it's not a harm to the securities markets. It doesn't contaminate, you know, securities markets. Doesn't affect the price of securities, right? Doesn't affect stock prices, does it?
Well, I mean, in a minimal sense, the securities are sold. There's trading that goes on using the proceeds of those securities, which would not otherwise have taken place but for the scheme. So, to the extent,
why not? Even if McConnell were an honest agent, there still would be trading, and you know, there'd still be investments and trading and so forth. How would it be any different?
Well, his authority to trade securities was limited by his authority under Illinois law as an independent administrator, and it certainly did not involve, as the trading occurred, listed options, naked short positions, all the kind of things that are simply not, would not be done appropriately by an independent administrator of an estate. And the only reason he was able to do that was because he had control of the estate securities, sold them, and consequently then had proceeds and margin securities in which to trade on.
Well, wouldn't that be true in any case where there was embezzlement from an estate? The embezzler would have different, trading goals from the estate, be less conservative trader. But wouldn't that turn every embezzlement case into a securities fraud case if the embezzler traded?
If it involved deception.
Well, embezzlement always involves deception.
But of course, our claim here is not limited to McDonald. Our claim, who had the duty to the estate. Our claim is that O'Meara independently committed deceptive acts, which were in connection with the purchase or sale of a security, and that constitutes the elements of a claim under Rule 10b-5a and 10b-5c, because neither the rule nor the statute limits the type of deception, limits the set of persons to whom it applies. The limitation is found in the provision that it must be in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. And in Zanford, Supreme Court clearly expansively defined the in connection with provision and provided that as long as the deceptive conduct and the securities transactions are not independent events, so that the fraud and the transactions coincide, then you have a fraud in connection with a purchase or sale of a security, so that the conduct is not limited by type or nature. The set of persons who can commit the violation is not limited to a particular set, as did the district court. And the limitation is found in whether the conduct is in connection with a purchase or sale of a security. And here we have it here. The account was opened within a matter of days, several days. The securities were sold and the trading began. Temporally, there is a relationship between the deception and the fraud on the estate. Similarly, there was no purpose for opening the account other than to commit the fraud, so that the in connection with that element, the limitation on the private cause of action, is met here by establishing that O'Meara's deception was in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. Now, I do want to once again to talk a bit about the aiding and abetting issue here, in that the complaint alleges specific deceptive conduct by O'Meara. It does not allege that O'Meara engaged in proper conduct, which, but for his recklessness, he would have known aided a defrauding party. Here, he himself engaged directly in deceptive conduct, and therefore is not an aider and abettor. And the district court's decision to dismiss the complaint based on the aiding and abetting provision was an error. Thank you. I see my time is
okay. Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Gallinari.
Good morning. My name is Christopher Gallinari. I represent Bear Stearns and Mr. O'Meara. There is I think, a very expansive reading of Zanford that is being undertaken by appellant, and I think it's an inappropriately expansive reading. I think Zanford was really designed to cure what was,
I don't understand why one should be reading Zanford at all. The question is, what is the meaning of the statute and the rules? Zanford just interprets them.
That's correct.
Our job is not to interpret Zanford. Our job is to apply the statute and the rule.
Well, I believe that in connection with the purchase or sale of securities has always been the subject of judicial interpretation over the years, and there has always been an understanding that not anything that merely touches upon securities or involves securities in any way necessarily falls within the scope of Section 10B. So then the question then becomes, what is within the scope of the statute and what is without the scope of the statute? And I believe that this set of facts is clearly without the scope of the statute. It deals more with the governance of the estate, not the customer-broker relationship, because the plaintiff was not a customer of Bear Stearns. It doesn't deal with the protection of investor confidence in the securities markets, because the facts did not impact upon any decision that was made by any person who ventured into the security markets to make a purchase or sale.
I just don't understand those things. Investor confidence in securities markets is not an element of the statute. It's not in the rule.
That is correct, but
that kind of argument was squarely rejected by this court in Jakubowski, by the Supreme Court in Naftalin. I mean, one should deal with what's in the statute and the rule and not made up elements like whether something affects the confidence in the market.
Well, that
if that were
is
an element, Naftalin, Zanford, and Jakubowski all would have come out the other way.
Well, every case applying Section 10B that I am aware of has dealt with the plaintiff making a purchase or sale of securities under facts similar to this, or cases where the price of a security on the open securities market is manipulated or contrived in some way because of some action that's taken by the defendant. Here, plaintiff argues that it's...
That's the very argument rejected in Zanford and Jakubowski.
Well, in Zanford...
We're not going to make a mistake that the Supreme Court has told us 9-0 not to make.
But in Zanford, the court focused on the duty to disclose that existed in the case of a discretionary account under Chiarella. It dealt with the fact that customers who trust brokers a little bit but who retain discretion can sue for securities fraud, but up until Zanford, a customer who placed complete confidence in a broker but who was cheated because the customer gave complete investment discretion to the broker couldn't sue. That was a wrinkle and inconsistency and illogical set of circumstances that existed under the law and under the cases that applied the law that needed to be corrected. And I think that Zanford, since Your Honor mentioned Zanford, I believe that Zanford should be read according to the facts and the reasoning that was applied by the court in Zanford. I don't believe that this case and the allegations of this case fall within the precedents that the appellant is trying to argue are in his favor. Plaintiff relies upon Flickinger, but even Flickinger says the fraud must be integral to the plaintiff's purchase or sale of the security in question. That doesn't happen here. It's plaintiff and appellant who tries to rely heavily upon Zanford. And in opposition, we have tried to show how Zanford is factually inapposite. In his reply brief, there are two new cases that he cites that both are inapposite. The Alico case, where the plaintiff was both a purchaser and had contracted to purchase securities under blue chip stamps. The Supreme Court said that type of person is considered a purchaser under Section 10B, so naturally that type of plaintiff would have standing to assert a claim under Section 10B. We don't have that here. The entity that traded securities in the Bear Stearns account was International Investments of Elgin, not the estate. In the James case, the seller of securities was a trust. The plaintiff was the beneficiary of that trust. So the issue in James was who had authority to speak on behalf of the seller, where the seller is an entity and not a natural person. Here, International Investments of Elgin was the seller of securities in the Bear Stearns account. There's no serious argument made by appellant that the estate somehow has the right to speak on behalf of International Investments of Elgin. I believe that James is no different than a case where a corporation trades securities in its account and a shareholder in the corporation challenges the corporate officer's actions, and when he's unsatisfied, then brings a derivative action on behalf of the corporation against the broker who the shareholder contends defrauded the corporation, causing harm to the corporation. And that's another point, because in the argument just recently, there was reference to the many instances where brokers scheme against customers and in doing so mislead their supervisors at their brokerage firms. But that's not what we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with anything that impacts upon the broker-customer relationship. We're not dealing with anything that impacts upon relationships between issuers of securities and the people who purchase from them or sell to them. We're not dealing with anyone's decision to go out into the public securities markets. So none of the underlying policy concerns that gave rise to Section 10B are implicated here. I'd also like to address the statute of limitations argument, because any basis present in the record can be used to sustain the decision below. And here, the cases point out the legislative history behind the amendment of 28 U.S.C. 1658, which show that the amendment is not to be given retroactive effect. The deceptive conduct that appellant just talked about during his argument was the deceptive conduct that occurred in connection with the opening of the account in November of 1998, I believe. So the claims are time barred by operation of the statute if they accrued on that date, and they did. I believe there was also an allegation that O'Meara and McDonnell represented in the account opening documentation that O'Meara had known McDonnell for a certain period of time, when the allegation is in fact they had known one another for a longer period of time than that, and that there was a net worth of the corporation of a certain amount, and that the introduction was made to O'Meara by way of a referral. Now, I question whether that is a well-pleaded allegation of fact or merely conclusory, because the allegation is made in the context of an allegation regarding O'Meara filling out an account application for... Yes, Your Honor.
As you're aware, surely a statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, and one doesn't have to plead around affirmative defenses in the complaint. This is doubtless why the district court didn't reach the statute of limitations issue.
There are several cases.
Is it your position that the complaint pleads the plaintiff out of court?
Yes, Your Honor.
But that's a different line of argument from saying, as you were now saying, well, the complaint wasn't specific enough or it didn't have enough in it. It doesn't have to have anything in it about the statute of limitations.
Well, the dates...
Only if it pleads everything that would foreclose any other showing, right? So that any other showing to show consistency with the statute of limitations would have to conflict with what's in the complaint.
I believe that is the case here, because the complaint contains the dates where a plaintiff alleges
the deceptive conduct
occurred.
It's the case all the time, but of course there are all sorts of things that extend the statute of limitations. That's not what allows the statute of limitations to be adjudicated on a 12b6 motion.
Well, there's no doctrines of equitable tolling under the previous Lampf rule. It's a 3-year statute of repose from the date of the transaction at issue. And the transaction that is at issue here are transactions that occurred more than 3 years before.
How much more?
I believe that the operative date is July 30, 1999.
How much more?
And November of 1998.
How much more?
Three, November, about 6 or 7 months, Your Honor. November of 2001 to July of...
You know, if it's 100 years or something, then yes, you can be pretty sure the statute of limitations is run and there's no defense. But if it's just a few months, it's less certain usually.
Well, I believe my time has expired, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gallinari. Mr. Schaefer, how much time does he have? A minute?
We're here today to ask you to interpret the statute and rule as it is written so that it is not limited to the type and nature of deceptive conduct, not limited to the set of persons who may violate the rule, not limited by the regulation to a particular kind of scheme, not limited by the regulation to a particular kind of deceptive act, practice, or course of business, but only limited by whether the fraud here is in connection with the purchase or sale of securities.
So you're saying if someone stole a share of stock, a stock certificate or something, from someone's safe deposit box, then went to a brokerage firm and opened an account and traded that stock, you would say that was a violation of 10b-5?
Well, if the person was an employee of the firm from which he stole the securities.
Why would that matter?
Well, because then he would have deceived his employer and acted improperly in that regard.
Well, that doesn't matter to you, because he would have deceived, you know, the brokerage firm when he said he owned the stock. Isn't that enough for your argument?
It would be... Yes, it would be enough because the deception...
Right. So,
deception
he wouldn't have to be an employee. He could be an ordinary thief.
Depending upon what he told the brokerage firm.
Right, so it wouldn't matter whether he was an employee of the firm from which he stole the stock.
If that
just would mean what he... It just would require that he say something deceptive to the brokerage firm.
And have that deception be in connection with the purchase or sale.
I don't understand. He goes to a brokerage firm and he says, I have this share of stock. I want you to trade it, make it multiply. That's all you need, right?
You would need to have the deception, and that would be sufficient.
Well, that is the deception.
Yes,
I just gave it to you.
And I'm saying...
So what are you trying to add? Why isn't my example sufficient under your theory of the case?
I'm assuming now that he told
Think
the brokerage firm it was
before
his.
Before you answer,
no,
I gave you the facts.
The deception.
Now, why don't the facts add up to a violation of the rule under your theory?
They would.
Well, good. Thank you.
They would.
Okay. Thank you very much. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel.
Thank you.